Good evening.
Good evening.
This is module 16, which consists of two talks on the Heart Sutra, or the Sutra of the Heart of Transcendent Knowledge. Before I actually begin, I want to provide a reminder that comes from all our gurus, and that reminder is never forget the Hinayana. I won't say too much more about that, but it is important to keep in mind when you hear something this radical. So part of my comments I've actually derived by studying this book. It's called The Heart Attack Sutra. It's by Carl Brunholzl, and the reference to that will be online. It's a very wonderful book. And I'm going to start by actually reading a little bit from what he has to say right at the introduction. In brief, what we can safely say about the Heart Sutra is that it is completely crazy. If we read it, it does not make any sense. Well, maybe the beginning and the end make sense, but everything in the middle sounds like a sophisticated form of nonsense, which can be said to be the basic feature of the Prajnaparamita Sutra. If we like the word know, we might like the sutra because that is the main word it uses. Know this, know that, know everything. We could also say that it is a sutra about wisdom, but it is a sutra about crazy wisdom. When we read it, it sounds nuts, but that is actually where the wisdom part comes in. What the Heart Sutra does is to cut through, deconstruct, and demolish all our usual conceptual frameworks, all our rigid ideas, all our belief systems, all our reference points, including any with regard to the spiritual path. It does so on a very fundamental level, not just in terms of thinking and concepts, but also in terms of our perception, how we see the world, how we hear, how we smell, taste, touch, how we regard and emotionally react to ourselves and others, and so on. This sutra pulls the rug out from underneath our feet and does not leave anything intact that we can think of, not even a lot of things that we cannot think of. This is called crazy wisdom. I guess I should give you a warning here that the sutra is dangerous to your samsaric sanity. So I'm going to go through and comment on different parts of it, starting at the beginning. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but at the beginning you hear, thus have I heard up through, he saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. So I'm going to comment on that portion of it now. And the comment is that this is setting the scene for everything that follows. It's setting the scene, and that's because it talks about the five excellencies. The first of these is the excellent time, and this, it begins thus. The word thus in Sanskrit is avam, thus have I heard. And that may not sound like a very specific time, like 7:30 p.m., but it means the time when there are sentient beings who have ripened to the point where at least some of them can hear this. So that's the excellent time. Then there's the excellent teacher, referred to here as the Blessed One. That is the Buddha. And you see, he does not say very much until the very end. In fact, he doesn't say anything for a long time. He enters the samadhi called profound illumination. That's what it says. That's what he did. Excellent teacher. Then there's the excellent place, and that is Vulture Peak Mountain. This is a real place. It's not something like high up on the Himalayas or anything like that. It's barely a little hillock in the middle of a flat plain, and it's best described by, since it's rather magical, by someone who's actually been there. So I'm going to defer to someone who has actually been there and seen it. Emily.
That's me. So yes, it says mountain, but really it's not a mountain. It's the plain is very flat. The whole area around there is very flat. And this is just a hill, basically, that you can walk up quite easily. And it's the Vulture Peak part comes from the rocks. So if you picture a vulture with those kind of pointy wings, that's the way the rocks are. They're like this, sort of. And you can go right up to where the Buddha gave his teachings. There's just a little, sort of a low wall that sort of encloses the space. And you could imagine people sitting there and looking out over this vast plain. So you get the idea, as if you are in India, you don't have any view, you're just on the ground. And this is quite a magical thing, to get that high up, to actually have a perspective to see out. And by contrast to your ordinary life, you have a much greater view, and you can see the sky and the whole space below you. The plain is vast. I just say that it's, I could imagine people being there at that time and experiencing something quite extraordinary and then hearing this teaching. So the place is very important in that the view is open, spacious, and unobstructed.
Thank you. That was the excellent place. The fourth excellency is the excellent retinue, or the audience who was present. And it says that it was a great gathering of monks and bodhisattvas. So the monks are people who the Buddha had trained in Hinayana, which means a great deal of meditation and a great deal of study of Buddhist psychology, which includes the five skandhas and all these other things you don't want to think about. And he taught that one could liberate oneself by completely understanding all the elements of mind, by dividing them up into smaller and smaller parts and looking at them and examining all experience in that way. So this is the way they were trained. And now they're in for a big shock. The bodhisattvas, the other part of the audience, are those who have transcended this view. It doesn't mean that they've tossed it in the garbage can, but they've transcended it, and their goal is to work for the enlightenment of all sentient beings rather than just to work on how to end suffering for themselves. So that is the distinction between Hinayana, which is self-liberation, Hinayana, small vehicle, and Mahayana, large vehicle, which is the commitment to work for the awakening of all sentient beings. And the fifth excellency is the excellent teaching. And here the excellent teaching, according to Carl Brunholzl, is profound illumination, which is what the samadhi that the Buddha entered at this time. Notice that the Buddha did not even say anything, but his profound samadhi caused Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, to have a great revelation, and he is the one who then did the teaching, and you will hear his voice. Yeah.
What's a bodhisattva, mahasattva?
A great bodhisattva.
A wicked good.
great being. Bodhisattva means bodhi being, a person who's awakened being. And a mahasattva, on top
great,
of that,
great
being.
Super
duper.
Right.
Oh, Eric, yes. Rupert.
What's a samadhi? I thought it was a place, but it sounds like
no. Samadhi is
state.
Samadhi is meditation.
Okay.
A much more powerful meditation than whatever we think we're doing when we meditate.
Okay. Although we don't know,
the Buddha is meditating and he's conveying the teaching by meditating.
Yes. Okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the excellent teaching.
So you don't really know if he's physically there.
It says he was there.
No.
Yeah.
It says the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagriha.
Dwelling there. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I was just
together
thinking he entered the samadhi.
Yeah.
But that's another kind of entrance.
He just sat down, basically, and went into very deep meditative absorption.
So, but before Avalokiteshvara could give his teaching, something very important had to happen. But it says, as then through the power of the Buddha, Venerable Shariputra asked a question. You see the question there?
Mm-hmm.
How should a son or daughter of noble family train who wishes to practice the profound Vajrapaṇipa? So it was the Buddha's empowerment that gave Shariputra the strength to ask the question. Now, he was not a bodhisattva. He was a monk. One who had attained the realization that monks attain, called being an arhat, one who had caused a cessation of personal suffering. And to ask a question like that takes great courage. Someone might say, well, I better not ask because I'm stupid. I'm the only one who doesn't understand it. I'm going to be very embarrassed if I ask the question. Yeah.
And right before that, though, it also seems, is it saying that Avalokiteshvara had some kind of realization?
Yes.
Saw in this way, he saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. So that's actually the first power of Buddha.
Yes.
In this samadhi.
Yes, in the samadhi. Yes, he.
In the samadhi.
Because of that, all of a sudden, the tremendous insight came to.
To hit right.
To have a
so that insight, and then the monk has this insight to ask this question.
Yes,
you could say. Okay.
So, it takes courage. It's also sort of elevates him to start behaving like a bodhisattva because it benefits all beings that he asks the question. It takes courage. When you ask a question in that way, you're helping everyone else by having the courage to do it. So,
is that merit? Is that the same as merit?
Is it merit?
Not necessarily.
It's something. In any case, it produced a vast result, and asking questions and having the courage to ask questions is extremely important. So,
but in the other thing we read last week about prajna, that from Judy Lee, that was one of the things she said, was that the prajna isn't the answers, it's the question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, having the courage to ask a question. If no one asks a question, it's very hard for teachers to teach. They're teaching in a vacuum. They don't know who's ready to listen to what or what is the right thing to say. So what did Avalokiteshvara say? And here he begins. Quote, O Shariputra, a son or daughter, and so on. And that particular paragraph up to thus Shariputra, all dharmas are emptiness. So that is the short answer, after which he gave a longer answer.
What's Datu?
What?
Datu. I Datu. No mind Datu, no Datu.
Well, if we go into the Ayatanas, the Datus, and every other thing, we'll be here all night. I think it would be better to say these are all constituents which are taught in the Hinayana that one can analyze and try to understand. So there's a big list of them, and you can see all the no's coming up. Okay? So it's, in some sense, it's refuting the ordinary view we have of these things. So previously the Buddha had taught the monks to analyze their experiences. Now they are told that this is just a temporary teaching. Something much bigger is being presented here. It doesn't mean we throw away the Hinayana, but something much bigger is being presented here. You have to give that up. No more analyzing experiences. They are already empty. Go beyond that. So, according to tradition, it said that some monks were so freaked out that they had heart attacks, or else they just ran away and they didn't like the teaching and didn't come back. We aren't really sure, but there's that tradition that some of them had heart attacks. Therefore, the title of this book, The Heart Attack Sutta.
That was one of Carl's students who came up with that, because that's what he thought the name was of the sutra. So Carl used it for his book.
So first he says four things. Form, which is duality of self and other, is empty. It has no nature of its own. So what is form? We're not going to go through all the skandhas tonight, but form is very easy to understand because it's what we all experience. Form means having the sense that there is myself as subject and something else object, and the action of experiencing the object. So if I feel pain, that's form. If I see a candle, that's form. If I have a nightmare, that's form. If I meet someone, that's form. I am other. It's what we do all the time, so we can't miss it. So form is empty. It has no nature of its own. So we're using emptiness to say that it's not anything we can grasp or get hold of. Secondly, he said, emptiness is form. It's emptiness that appears as form. So we cannot find anything that appears independent of emptiness. There is no form without emptiness. And then he put it another way. Yes?
I don't remember it.
It doesn't make sense.
You're saying words and you're making senses, but are we supposed to be able to make sense out of that?
No.
Okay.
Okay, but on the other hand, you can't get away from it.
Can you repeat? Form is emptiness.
Yeah.
And then after that, can you kind of repeat what you said?
Form is, okay, they're right there. Form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. So emptiness is not something that can exist. It can only exist as be as form. It can't be an emptiness without form either.
So emptiness appears as form.
Yes, that's right. The only way it can appear is as form.
But it's not form.
We're going to go on to that. Don't jump the gun. Wait a minute.
We all jump the gun.
So,
daughter of noble family.
That's very good. You just went on to the next one. So, emptiness is no other than form. Emptiness is not something that can exist on its own independent of form. And then form is no other than emptiness. Form is not something that can exist apart from emptiness. So he's put it in a variety of ways so that any way you try to analyze it, you're going to be wrong. So, is it logical? No, it breaks down any attempt to form to have an idea that you understand emptiness and form by any form of conceptual thinking.
That's an important point.
Okay. That's the main point. No matter how you take it, any theory you have about it, any explanation, isn't going to work.
All right.
He's blocked out all possible explanations.
Go ahead.
I feel in some ways it makes sense. Maybe I'm crazy. But,
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, probably I am.
You're really advanced. Okay.
Well, no, I mean, the only way to understand one thing is to know the other.
Yeah.
And right. So that's yeah, it's like the only way I can know what is form is the absence of, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So it does make sense to me.
So they define each other.
Yeah.
Why is that wrong if it does make sense?
Well, I don't know that it's wrong. She's saying she understands that she has.
She's been practicing. She's been reciting this for the last year.
But this makes sense to me.
And so she's gotten more acclimatized, right? Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, we recite this, and actually, in reciting it, we begin to get it. It's very interesting. We don't get it because we start putting things together. It's already there. But in the recitation, this is why this can be a very good daily recitation, is that it helps us simply relax into this truth. And this truth speaks for itself. That's why, as Michael's saying, when you start to analyze it, you're going away from it. You just need to rest in it. It's very profound.
Can I ask a different? So, shunyata, is that a name for emptiness, or is that a name for something?
Yeah, shunyata is equals. Sanskrit.
It's just a Sanskrit word.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it doesn't try to talk. It doesn't talk about emptiness. Well, it's not quite direct about realization. It does talk about emptiness for sure. And then it goes on, in the same way, feeling, perception, concepts, and consciousness are emptiness. Now those are
our friends, the
skandhas. Those are our friends, the skandhas. So rather than going into each skandha, the shortcut here is, since you can say form is emptiness, emptiness is no other than form, you could do it with feeling is emptiness, and so on, all four of them through that one, and that one, and that one, and that one. So, it's a shortcut for a lot of work, or a lot of listening, or a lot of expanded recitation, I guess, if you want to do that. At this point, you don't really have to know what the skandhas are. What's important is to understand that the skandhas are said to be a complete catalog of all possible things that we experience. And it's not the only possible catalog.
This is Buddhism. What else is
there? There's 23 of.
Yeah, that is, yes.
So, I was listening to Pema today in my walk, and something she said that I think I see in here, which is change is constant. Everything changes. And since it's constantly changing, there is no moment where it is what it is. It's not.
Okay.
So that kind of, I see that as working in here. No feeling is permanent. It's constantly changing.
Right.
Even minutely. So you can't point at it and go, there it is, because it's gone.
Yeah.
It's changed.
Yeah, impermanence is a way of seeing the ephemeral quality of what we think of as anything that could be a little solid. That's certainly true. Most modern psychologies have ways of analyzing all possible moments of experience. If we had another half an hour, Michael could explain to you how Gurdjieff had a different way of explaining it, not five skandhas, but something else. So it's not unique that there are catalogs of how to catalog all possible experiences and make them into a list. But this is a very traditional Buddhist list. It makes a great deal of sense when you start to get into it very thoroughly.
And we will get into it more thoroughly.
We're going to beat you into it. Shall I go on?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, now we come to the famous catalog of no's. There are no characteristics. There is no birth, no cessation, no purity, so on. So look at that list, increase and decrease. No form, no feeling. So he's saying for each skanda, there's no skanda form. There's no skanda of this and that and that. Then he says there's no eye. Now those are called dhatus, I believe. No ear, no nose, no body, up to no mind. And then there's another catalog which are called ayatanas. And here we have no appearance, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no dharmas, no eye dot, no sorry, those are... Which one?
Eye dot too.
Yeah.
So actually Emily said... So you introduced it last week. You summarized basically. You have the sense organs. You have the ayatanas, the fields, which incorporates that the actual, and then you have the totality of the seeing eye, the object, and the act of seeing. All of those together make 18 dhatus. Those are dhatus elements.
18.
It's just basically elements. That constitute how
six
our times
three.
So these are all the things that these monks were taught to work on, because if they understand them thoroughly, then they can attain personal liberation. And they worked on them very hard, and they had a lot of investment in this when they came to Vulture Peak Mountain.
No wonder they had a heart attack.
Yeah.
All that
can
work.
You imagine figuring this out and following all those 300 rules?
They really didn't understand that they still thought they existed. I mean, there was some sense of accomplishment, right? And you just tore that out from under them.
So, no mind consciousness, dhatu, no ignorance, no end of ignorance, up to no old age and death. No end of old age and death. No suffering, no origin of suffering. What's this list here? No
cessation.
Four noble truths.
Right.
No cessation of suffering.
Okay, wait.
What does it mean up to no old age? Up to no old age.
Well, he's going through a catalog.
He's going through what's called
this
nidanas.
It's called
nidanas.
12 nidanas. We have
starts with ignorance, and then it goes all the way up to. It's basically the cycle of experience.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
All those awesome numbers list of categories.
Michael brought out the Wheel of Life, which had the entire. I don't know if you were here.
It sounds
when
like he's
that.
Going through a lesson.
But if you look at the Wheel of Life, it's got the whole shebang. The 12 nidanas are all
12 nidanas, which are absolutely incomprehensible.
Wow.
Not.
But it's the way we suffer. Basically, it's how we construct our world. And these are all, it's like the alphabet. A, B, C. And you're getting the alphabet, and these are the building blocks for how we construct our solid world that makes us solid, because we see a solid world out there. So what is being done here is cut that one. And especially when you think about the Buddha, the famous Buddha, and all these people following the Buddha, and he gives this teaching called the Four Noble Truths. You know, these are like the most profound. It's like the Word of God, you know. I mean, this is really profound. Oh, except take that out of the notes. But, it's, but
But it's such a shock to these people. You can imagine. And then he says, there's no suffering. You kidding me? That was all he talked about. And then there's no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path. We've been working all this time to follow all your rules. You got to be kidding. You know, I mean, can you imagine how you feel? Like you accomplished everything you were told to do and then forget it. So that's, if you feel upset, that's good, because this is about getting upset. This is about
pulling the rug underneath any belief. Yeah.
So it's a cutting down of all these solid beliefs that we build up. But there's more to come. So I say first, just relax and take the ride and just be open. Because if you're going to shut down right at the gate, there won't be any room to see the wisdom. The wisdom won't show through.
Except that here it says no wisdom.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Okay, well, there's not.
But there is something that is positive. Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of prajna paramita.
Yeah.
And nowhere does it say there is no means of prajna paramita. There is no abiding by means of prajna. Does not contradict that.
Well, you actually don't. But you're using prajna paramita to just do that very thing, to abide in open space, to abide in basically emptiness form. So instead of saying form, you're saying emptiness form. Appearance, emptiness. You're recognizing the total kind of provisional quality. We're labeling everything and thinking those are absolute. Mm-hmm. It's just our projection. If we pull the projection away, or we just look at, if we open ourselves up to the open nature, then that can't be solid anymore. It sort of becomes more diaphanous, luminous.
So the bodhisattvas abide by means of prajna paramita, abiding in emptiness.
Did you get the last few no's? Because it says no wisdom.
Right.
No non-attainment.
No attainment.
Yeah, so anything, any form of belief is prohibited.
But isn't prajna is wisdom, right?
Yeah.
So the prajna paramita is the last one we studied.
We studied that last.
Which is wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he says there is no wisdom, and then it says they abide by means of.
That's the wisdom. The wisdom is that there is no wisdom.
Well, prajna is insight. It's more than wisdom.
Dharma, no dharma.
It's transcendent.
It's transcendent, right. Transcendent.
Remember, let's go back for a minute. We're not just going into some strange territory. Prajna is the faculty of the mind that actually sees the empty nature. That's what we talked about. So this is what's going on.
Yeah.
We're exercising this particular capacity we have to see reality, which is completely ultimate, what we call ultimate bodhicitta. Remember our ultimate or absolute bodhicitta? We've talked about that. Yeah. When we do Tonglen, we flash on that first. It's just this complete openness without labeling and grabbing and stabilizing. You're just flash, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this prajna is actually the faculty, the part of ourselves that is capable of doing this. Mm-hmm. It's our own capacity. Completely natural.
Mm-hmm. But it's nothing to hold on to.
So he's kind of saying, like, you did all this work.
Yeah.
Like, you work. It's sort of like The Wizard of Oz, where she, like, does all this horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the guy says, oh, you could have just come home whenever you wanted.
Yeah.
And she's like, what?
That's good enough.
Like, I did all this work, and you're like, you had, it was all there all the time.
It's all good.
Yeah.
You needed to do that work. Probably, at least many people needed to do that work in order to get to that moment of being able to, actually have this happen, to actually have this dawn, and they can actually, we're just caught up in our sky, in our skandhas that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. We can't unglue. We're so stuck with our projections and our hopes and fears, right? We can't see this openness. even so, though it's fundamentally in our face.
So, Carl Bunholzer makes a very important point here, that there's no refutation of relative truth in that list. That is, it doesn't say no chairs, no cushions, no coffee, no Facebook, no chapel. He's not interested in saying no to relative truth. He's saying no to all our concepts and beliefs, of which we don't even know how many there are, because this list is just sort of the tip of an iceberg, and most of the iceberg is kind of submerged, and we haven't even gotten anywhere near it yet.
See, that's why I didn't understand right that comment that you just made when he says no eye, no ear, no nose, no
okay.
tongue.
I want to work on one of them now, okay?
My goodness.
Jeez.
I want to
hold out your
tongue. Wow! You're a dark sort.
What is this?
A grater.
Cheese grater.
Okay, a cheese grater, a food grater, whatever.
Grater of anything.
No, just a straight answer. Don't try to be smart.
It's a grater.
It's a grater.
An instrument, a musical instrument.
I don't think so. Well, yes, it could be.
You
can start to see strange things, but just be ordinary. What is it? It's a food grater.
A piece of metal.
Okay. Is this part of it rough or smooth? In other words, if I were to start rubbing my fingers here with pressure, would it start abrading my fingers, or is it really smooth? What?
Depends on which way you go.
You go down, up and down.
You go up and down.
Okay, but it is rough, at least in one direction.
Yeah.
Everyone agrees with that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. You're right. Okay. So, if one of those no's is no I, so what does that mean? It means at least our sense of using an I is not as simple, is not as obvious as what we thought. When we say, I see a grater and it's rough, we aren't just seeing this. We're seeing all our, we're taking all our past experience and memories and inferences. So to say, I see a rough grater is actually a sophisticated act of construction. Right? Okay, so the Prajnaparamita Sutra is suggesting that for each of those no's of something that looks perfectly obvious in most cases, we could go into it more deeply. And we're not giving it up. We're not saying, I'm going to become stupid and not understand what it is. We're not throwing away our experience, but we're realizing that our experience is a much faster construction than we ordinarily take it to be. It's not what it first seems. And every one of those no's has such a quality. And then we come to the next part that was already mentioned. Since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they arrive by means of Prajnaparamita. This is an attempt to describe using words, which are the only things we have, what a bodhisattva might see or what a Buddha might see. That is, they're not trying to do anything, and therefore they actually are resting in Prajnaparamita. And because they're not trying to do anything, their minds are not obscured by all the constructs we have to confuse ourselves. And even more of that, because the bodhisattva is simply resting, awake and resting, there's no fear. This is actually very significant, because as we start to get even little tiny glimpses of this, we're on a journey in which our own fears start to soften. So there is path there.
So, since all these are, it says, it's like translated one language, like it's been translated a couple of times. What is meant by fear? What
do you experience as fear?
Yeah. Any time I look at something, I want it to be other than the way it is.
Mm. Okay, that's a sophisticated answer. As opposed to I'm afraid of it and I don't want it to go there. So there is no fear. They transcend falsity. They don't have confusing views about what's real and what's not real. And they attain complete nirvana. And this is not a nirvana contrasted to samsara. This is something for which there's no contrast, actually resting in nirvana, which point one is virtually become a Buddha. All the Buddhas of the three times, by means of Prajnaparamita, fully awakened to unsurpassable, true, complete enlightenment. So there that is, described in our own language. I'm going to stop this outline here because at this point, having said this, Avalokiteshvara has completed the teaching, but he doesn't stop now. He goes into another topic, mantra, and I think we'll let Michael take that up next week. You ready?
Sure.
Okay. So we have time for a few more objections or questions or confusions or whatever.
What does Buddhas of the Three Times mean?
Pardon?
What does it mean, all the Buddhas of the Three Times?
So oh, the three times.
Cycles?
Mm-hmm. Past, present, future.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All the Buddhas that have been, those that are here now, and all those that will come abide by means of Prajnaparamita and attain complete awakening. So this is a natural phenomenon. It doesn't say that there has to be just one Buddha. It's or just one planet on which it happens, as opposed to hundreds of thousands of universes or whatever. It's the nature of reality that it can wake itself up. Yeah. That it could get confused and that it can wake itself up. That's what's real. In infinite universes. It's pretty vast.
Well, we couldn't wake up if we weren't asleep, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one involves the other.
That's good news, actually.
No hope.
But it's not on this list. No sleep, no.
No what?
Waking, no sleep, no waking.
Ultimately, yes.
Yeah, that's right. All there. It would be on that list.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is absolutely. I mean, this is what an absolute statement is, if there is an absolute statement. So by reciting this, we actually open our minds up to this dimension, which is actually already present. It's never been anywhere else. And make it accessible to us because we're making ourselves accessible to it.
Sounds like it's in line with one of Lojong's sayings, release even the truth.
How's that go?
Is that it?
Release even the truth or let go.
It says, self-liberate the antidotes. Mm-hmm. Is perhaps what you're thinking of.
Yeah.
Right.
Self-liberate the antidotes.
Right.
So if you want to recite this in your when you do your daily practice, you could do it before you begin your practice or at the end if you wish. But and then just feel the energy of it and see what happens. And do it if you wish. And it's online, so we want to collect these back because we're going to keep these here for other people as we come in and out. But you can go online and print out a copy for yourself to use in your daily practice if you wish.
I had another question when we went to Anam Tukjun's, I can't remember his name. Mm-hmm. When he did his retreat,
he repeated the mantra many times.
Yeah.
And that's something that can be done.
Right.
It's only once that you just recite this particular verse, but there's no reason, why can't be. He does it a long time, as I recall.
The Hindus use, don't they? I don't know.
I don't think so.
No, they don't?
It's got a really cool sound.
Maybe the first time I heard it was through Ram Dass, but maybe that was just incorporating that Buddhist.
He did say that. Ram Dass used to say. A lot of people in the 60s and 70s, particularly the 70s, were using this mantra freely and using chant to sort of pacify and cool down and make everybody feel better.
Can we know what it is? And how it translates?
Well, we're going to talk about that. Not to worry. That's next week.
We'll leave that till next week, okay?